Welcome to the second in a series of lectures in our Science and Faith series. This is the third series of lectures we've had, and our speaker this year is Dr. Robert Newman. Last night he spoke on campus, as most of you know, on Cosmos and Contact, the religion of Carl Sagan. And basically the premise there was that Carl Sagan makes statements that are not statements of science, but are statements of faith, like the cosmos is all that is, all that was, and all that ever will be, which is clearly not a statement of science. And tonight, Dr. Newman's going to speak on cosmology and the Bible, a tour of astronomical evidence relevant to the nature of the cosmos and its fit with biblical statements. And then for those of you that can make it, we encourage you to attend tomorrow at 9 a.m. He's going to be speaking on computer viruses, artificial life, and the origin of life. And then in the evening at 7 p.m., we're going to have an open discussion. And then Sunday again at 9 a.m., he's going to be speaking on Jesus, the testimony of the prophets. As always, Pastor likes to get his money's worth when we have a visiting speaker. Dr. Newman received a Ph.D. in astrophysics from Cornell, and then he went on and got a Master of Divinity from the Faith Theological Seminary, and then a Master's of Sacred Theology in Old Testament from the Biblical, Biblical Theological Seminary. I got a mental block there for a minute, where he is presently a professor of New Testament and the director of the Interdisciplinary Bible Research and Biblical Research Institute. He's the author of a couple of books and a number of other tracts, and I believe we have copies of at least the one book, Genesis 1 and the Origin of the Earth, in the back. Oh, both of them, okay. And also they have a website, which is a very nice website and has a lot of other information. It's very easy to get to. It's www.biblical.edu, and that gets you to the theological seminary. And then from there you can go to the Interdisciplinary Biblical Research Institute. So, without further delay, Dr. Newman.
Thanks very much. We want to look at two subjects that are potentially very vast subjects tonight, the cosmos and the Bible. But actually the talk is going to be dealing with evidence in nature, what the cosmos is like, and then near the end, some of the biblical statements about the cosmos, and rather interestingly, how they fit with these particular matters. What's cosmology? Well, it's a study of the universe, but to make a little clearer some of the difficulties that we face in cosmology, we can speak of it in this way, that cosmology is a study of the known parts of the universe to try to describe the whole universe. And obviously the difficulty of trying to decide how much of the universe you're looking at. And then interpreting information presently reaching the Earth to try to reconstruct the entire history of the cosmos. So there are certainly some difficulties that face us when we think about what cosmology is all about. And we do need to think about the importance of cosmology. One scientist has suggested that cosmology is a waste of time. We don't know enough to be able to say anything intelligently about the whole universe or its history and such. And so his idea, this is Hannes Alfvén, a Danish physicist, would be to not waste any time on the particular subject. The trouble with that particular solution is that it is very, very important. On top of that problem, there have been a large variety of cosmological models, of pictures of how the universe is thought to fit together and such, proposed particularly in this century, and yet it's obviously one of the most basic questions we can ask ourselves. What is the universe all about? Where do I fit in it? Does it have any meaning? It is a question that is too important to be ignored. Importance of cosmology biblically, the Bible have to say. Well, the Bible certainly places a big premium on cosmology. We don't usually think of it that way. But the Bible is very definite that the universe is created. And that the universe is created then is going to make a huge difference on whether it's got any meaning, whether our life has got any meaning or not. That its creator is a person, that we're not talking about some kind of force, you know, like in The Force Be With You, but we are concerned that we're going to have to deal with a person, that the creator, according to the Bible, will one day call us to account for every thought and action, very scary thing, that we will have to one day face the creator of the universe. And another point the Bible makes is that the creator has embedded evidence in the cosmos that it was created. We talked about some of that last night, though we will hit a few things in that direction here this evening as well. So, importance of cosmology biblically. Universe created, the His creator is a person. He's going to call us to account one day, and he has put evidence in the universe that it was created. The importance of cosmology scientifically, again, we come back to one of the most basic questions of science. One of the interesting things that we find scientifically is that since World War II, and especially in the last 10 years or so, the scientific evidence that relates to cosmology is far more extensive than ever. Of course, the same amount of evidence has been arriving here at this planet all our lives and for thousands of years back, but we now have some way of detecting a good deal more of that than we ever did, and some materials by which we can interpret it as well. The development of radio telescopes after World War II was rather important because it opened a whole new window into the universe that we did not have before that time. The growing understanding of nuclear and particle physics by physicists has turned out to be very, very important. I was talking to the chairman of the physics department here at UC Davis, a believing Christian, and he thought it was rather ironic that that we learn something about the universe, the biggest thing that we, the creative thing that we know about, by studying the very smallest things that we can learn about, by studying the elementary particles. Artificial satellites that have been put up above our atmosphere have allowed us to see things and detect things that we could not detect before. We think of the COBE satellite that was put up that detected in detail the radiation that we think came from the Big Bang. The Hubble Space Telescope that has a clearer view than any scope here down on the Earth. I might mention, besides these, though it didn't make it on my overhead here, that there's been a breakthrough in the technology of constructing optical telescopes, so that where 20 years ago we seemed to be stuck, that it was hard to build any telescope with a mirror bigger than 200 inches, there's been a breakthrough in technology to do that, and now we're getting some really big telescopes developed or in process right now. Interestingly, the scientific evidence of cosmology points to a created cosmos. So, overview of what we're going to try and do this evening. We're going to look at scientific data relevant to cosmology. We're going to start in close and kind of move out further. That's kind of the idea we have in mind there. We're going to, on the way, look at various cosmological models at times when they appear to be relevant, when something we've just said impacts on them one way or another. Some of these will be models proposed by secular scientists. Some of these will be models proposed by Bible believers. And then kind of at the end of our tour, we're going to try and suggest a best model using both the scientific and the biblical data. So that's the direction we want to try and go. We start out with the nature of stars. Cosmologists are primarily interested in stars and the groupings of stars that we call clusters and galaxies and superclusters and that sort of thing, rather than planets and such. Obviously, if there were no planets in the universe, we'd be in bad shape, but cosmologists have tended to concentrate on the stars, though they are interested in the question of dark matter that we cannot detect by visible means, but that we have some evidence of from gravitational effects. Our sun, we think, is a nice sample star that we can view rather close up. And to be rather simple about this, our sun is a massive ball of gas. It's enormously larger than our Earth. If we compare our Earth, say, to the size of a marble, then the planet Jupiter would be about the size of a basketball. And if we shrink that planet down to about the size of a marble, then our sun would be about the size of a basketball. So you've got that kind of size thing there. It's held together by its gravity, even though it is very, very hot. The temperature on the surface of the sun, and the sun doesn't have a surface like, you remember, the one group that's usually the butt of various ethnic jokes was going to fly to the sun. And the question was, how are they going to do that? Well, they're going to go at night and such. Well, the problem of landing on the surface of the sun is it does not have a physical surface, but it has an optical surface. That is, as you look at the sun through a telescope or something of that sort, don't try this with your telescope, but if you look at the sun through properly designed equipment, you see that it looks kind of clear up here, and then suddenly you hit a surface and it looks very bright, but looks solid down here. And that's the point where the gases below there are ionized and opaque, and above that they're not ionized and they're transparent. So at that surface, there's a temperature of thousands of degrees, whether we're talking Fahrenheit or Celsius, and millions of degrees in the center of the sun. The heat produced in our sun and in most of the stars that we see out there, the stars we call the main sequence stars, is produced by a nuclear reaction very similar to that of a hydrogen bomb, but it's a controlled nuclear reaction. At those very high temperatures, hydrogen can collide and stick together, and with sufficient number of collisions, it produces helium, and about 3% of the mass there is converted to energy, and that is the enormous amount of energy put out by our sun. Our particular sun, kind of an average star, puts out energy equal to 2 billion 50 megaton hydrogen bombs per second. So rather substantial. There appears to be enough hydrogen in a star the size of our sun to burn for about 10 billion years if the star can get access to all of it and such. I don't know whether that would actually function in that way or not. So that's what our sun is like, and we're suggesting our sun is a star. Well, that continues with our discussion of the nature of stars then. How do we know that our sun is a star or that stars are suns? And they're obviously look a lot dimmer. They look awfully small. No telescopes that any of us are likely to have would allow you to see the disk of any of these stars. They just look like a point, or if they didn't look like a point, just because you've got bad optics in your telescope. But if you look at them, we really have only recently developed equipment that could show a disk for a star. So how do we know that suns are stars? Well, we need to measure the distance to them in the first place. And how do you measure the distance to a nearby star? Well, tape measures aren't long enough. We haven't been there and back. How do we know? We use a distance measuring technique that was very commonly used on naval equipment, on naval ships, for being able to figure out the distance they needed to fire their guns. And that was used up until the invention of radar. And that was a technique in which you look through what looked like a pair of binoculars, but the light that was coming to your two eyes was not coming in right here, but it was coming from maybe 10 feet apart, the two different things, and you're bringing it together. And the two images would be looking at the distant ship or the fortification on the coast or whatever you're shooting at, would be looking from a slightly different angle. And so you'd make adjustments until you lined something up that showed you came back and showed you what the distance was. Earlier cameras, I can remember at least in the 50s, that they were still making spy cameras, that you would look through and turn the thing, and you would have a split image, and you would turn the focus adjustment until the image lined up, and that would be showing you the distance then. Well, we use something like that. The easiest test of our own is the jumping finger test. You hold your finger up like this with a wall, say, some distance away, and you look at it with one eye, and then you look at it with the other eye, and your finger appears to jump. And why is it doing that? You're looking from a slightly different direction, and your finger appears to jump against the background. Now, if you do that with a star, and you look at it with one eye, and you look at it with the other eye, they don't jump. Why is that? Because your eyes are only about 2 inches apart. You need eyes further apart than that. How far apart? Well, what is typically done is to use the width of the Earth's orbit, about 186 million miles. And so you take a photograph looking off this way in March, and then you wait till 6 months later, October, September, whatever it is, and you take another picture then, and the nearest stars will appear to have shifted slightly against the background of the other stars. That's called parallax. And the nearest stars will shift just a very small amount. It would be very hard to measure by just eyeballing it, but with setting the two plates side by side and flipping your vision back and forth so you see one and then the other, a couple of stars will appear to move a little bit. And that is a way of measuring stars. We can probably measure the distance to the nearest 1,000 stars out to perhaps 100 light years away. 100 light years is 100 times the length that light travels in a year, 6 trillion miles. So we can measure perhaps the nearest 1,000 stars in that particular way. Now, once we get the distances, then we can figure out from the apparent brightness of the stars what their actual brightness is, because the brightness of a source like that goes down as the square of the distance. If it's some distance away, you get certain brightness. If it's twice that far away, you get 1/4 the brightness. If it's 3 times that far away, you get 1/9 the brightness, and such the square of the increasing distance. So what we find out then by doing that is that for the stars whose distances we can measure, those stars are as bright as the sun. They range over a fairly wide range of brightness, but the sun would fall in the middle of that somewhere. So that would seem to suggest that they're the same kind of brightness as the sun. It's also possible to measure the masses, the weights of stars. This can only be done when two stars or more are revolving around one another, and then there's a way to calculate their total weight, the sum of the two weights. some of the two masses. And what we find out from that is that stars that we can do that for, they cover a range of masses that includes our sun. And what we find then, with looking at these 1,000 closest stars, is that they vary greatly in size, they vary greatly in mass, they vary rather substantially in their color. You can actually even see that by going out and looking at stars at night. They don't vary as much in color as neon lights do, but they vary from a somewhat reddish color through kind of a whitish color over to a very slightly bluish color. And that represents a substantial difference in temperature of the star at its surface. In plotting these 1,000 stars on a graph in which you have the brightness of the star as your vertical direction on your graph and the color of the star as your horizontal direction on the graph, you find that a large number of the stars fall more or less along a line that's called the main sequence stars. And we now know that that has to do with the fact that those stars are currently burning hydrogen in their core. And that's kind of what we might call the prime of their life. Then we have some other stars that are off that we call red giant stars, and some others that we call white dwarf stars, and we have some variable stars and things of that sort, which I'll not trouble you with here. So we do learn something about the nature of stars, just looking at these 1,000 or so closest stars. That already allows us to respond to one suggestion which has been made, and that is that our universe is really quite small. Most of you out here in California are familiar with Harold Camping, the founder of Family Radio, a man who is a sincere Christian and doing an excellent work in seeking to spread the gospel. And yet I don't think his model here is very satisfactory. He basically suggests that the whole universe is only a few light years across, and so that light from the most distant object in the universe reached the Earth within a few years of creation. He is, I think, trying to respond to a problem that young Earth creationists have, those who believe the Earth was created in the last few 1,000 years. And that is the question of why can we see all the way to the edge of the universe? And Camping's suggestion is the universe is only a few light years across. He basically argues that the parallax method shows us that these 1,000 nearest stars are closer than the rest, but it doesn't show you how far the background stars are that you cannot measure by the parallax method. And he then argues that all distance measurements used on the background stars are unreliable. Well, is that really so? I think not. There are a number of techniques that we can use that, as best we can tell, are reliable, short of being able to actually fly out there and back and measure the distance, seem to be reliable. We know, for instance, that there are a number of stars that rotate around each other, what we call binary stars. And we can actually measure the speed at which those stars are rotating by looking at the star as it's coming toward us on one side of its orbit and then as it's going away from us on the other side of the orbit. And we use a technique a little bit like that which the state police use to catch you when you're driving too fast. And that is measuring the frequency of the light from these stars. We can tell how fast the star is moving as it moves towards us and moves away from us. We can figure out then at that speed how long it would take to go all the way around, and that will crank out a length of that orbit all the way around. And that will tell you then, since you can see how big the orbit is by looking at it in the sky, it'll tell you how far away the star is. And lo and behold, the dimmer stars out there are not just a light year or two beyond the brighter stars. They are way out there. Some of them hundreds and even thousands and even millions of light years away, though most of our stuff with binary stars would be for closer than that. A second problem with this idea of a miniature universe is that the dimmer stars would be too small to hold their gas at that temperature. You can tell by looking at the color of the light what the temperature of the star is on its surface, and a dimmer star at another light year past the close ones wouldn't have enough gravity to hold on to that gas. It'd just disperse. But it's not. And the reason, I think, is that it's much further away and it's much bigger, and it's got enough mass to hold on to that gas. When we look at clusters of stars out there, we can see that they too fall in the same pattern of main sequence and red giants and white dwarfs. And so we can plot just that cluster, and then we can say, okay, this is all based on the apparent brightness of those things. Now let's try and compare it with the 1,000 nearest ones and convert it to an absolute brightness. And when we do that, we get great distances for those stars. So clusters of stars, again, point in the same direction. So that's what we did there. Both cluster stars way out there and nearby stars would be explained by the same energy mechanism, turning hydrogen into helium, if these clusters are at great distances. So I think enough said. Very serious problem with that kind of attempt to avoid this particular problem. We move out then from our stars to big collections of stars, what we call galaxies. We call our galaxy the Milky Way, and if you get out somewhere where you're far enough away from city lights, you can actually see kind of a band of stars, a band of light across the sky. Can't even tell for sure whether it's stars or not. And that is a part of our galaxy that we're inside, which we call the Milky Way, based on an old Greek name. Galaxies are a huge collection of stars, ranging up to many hundreds of billions of stars. Our galaxy, the Milky Way, is one of the larger ones in it's actually second largest in our cluster of galaxies, local cluster, and perhaps has 200 billion stars, something like that, with the largest one, the Andromeda, perhaps twice that big, and a number of little galaxies around. But the shape of these big clusters of stars that we call galaxies, some are shaped like pinwheels or spirals, ours is. Most of them are shaped like spheres or footballs or M&Ms. Spheres, prolate spheroids, and oblate spheroids, if you want to be more technical, etc. Perhaps 90% of the stars are that way, about 10% are spirals, and just a few, a percent or less, are rather shapeless galaxies that we call irregulars. These galaxies appear to be at distances of millions to billions of light years. Our particular galaxy isn't that far away, we're in it, okay? But the nearest bigger galaxy than ours, the Andromeda one, is perhaps 2 million light years away. And we have detected ones that seem to be some billions of light years away. All of that depends upon certain distance measurements. So we have to think a little bit about that. How do you measure distances to galaxies? You don't do it by parallax. A mere 186 million miles across our orbit is nowhere near big enough to show up as any kind of jump of the finger, if you like, at the distances we're talking about with galaxies. So you cannot use that method. Most of the methods depend on some type of estimate of what the actual brightness of the object we're looking at is, and then comparing that with the apparent brightness and working out one of these inverse square things that the apparent brightness drops as the square of the distance as you go further and further away. For instance, we can make up a main sequence of the stars in the Andromeda galaxy and show that would suggest that it's on the order of 2 million light years away from us. We can look at certain variable stars. We have some variable stars that are quite regular, that they take anywhere from a day or so to maybe a week or so to go from bright to dim to bright again. And one class of these, called Cepheid variables, the length of time it takes to go from bright to dim to bright is also a measure of its absolute brightness. Say the peak brightness or the minimal brightness, either one would work all right. And so you can actually, then when you recognize those characteristic features of that star, you can figure out how far away it is then by looking at its apparent brightness and comparing it with its calculated absolute brightness. The brightest stars in galaxies seem to have some kind of an upper limit. The brightest clusters, particularly what we call globular clusters, seem to have a upper limit sort of thing as well, and so can make estimates of those. And we can see brightest stars in a galaxy from some distance away, and brightest globular clusters, we're talking of perhaps 100,000 stars from even much further away, so we can begin to get some outer distance measurements. And we think, but here we're on a little weaker ground, that brightest galaxies in a cluster tend to have a maximum brightness as well, and that gives us some estimates. So these measuring techniques go down in strength and certainty as we get further and further out, but they don't go to zero, and they ought to be able to tell the difference between 5 light years and 500,000 light years, and that's the sort of thing that we're concerned about there. Now, there's been another proposal that has been made, that our universe is, yes, physically big, but it's optically small, that the universe that we see is really only our neighborhood reflected many, many times, proposed by two, as far as I know, secular scientists in a fairly reputed journal, and yet has not attracted much attention. They basically showed that some features of Einstein's theory of relativity could be explained without proposing that Einstein's theory of relativity was right if light travels in circles of radius 5 light years instead of traveling in straight lines. And so I don't know whether they really believe that or not, but it was certainly a provocative thing to suggest. And so the suggestion then would be made, perhaps our universe is really just the dozen or so stars within 5 light years of us, and there are multiple images seen by us. You know, you've been in a clothing store sometime, perhaps, and seen a situation where you've got a mirror here on one side and a mirror here on the other side. Turn around here and you can see about 1,000 of you disappearing off into the background over there. And so the idea is that you've got something like that in the universe. You're looking out there and you're seeing all of these stars there. This view attracted rather little interest in secular circles, but a good deal among young Earth creationists. And is a little bit of a danger, I think, that young Earth creationists tend to fall into, and that is grabbing on things that really are not warranted. All of us have a tendency to do that. If something comes up that we like, and we tend to be less critical about ideas we like and more critical about ideas we don't like. We have to watch out for that. The Lord doesn't want us judging by double standards. Biblical problems with an optically small universe. The Bible indicates there are a huge number of stars, like the grains of sand on the seashore, not just a few stars of which we see multiple images. Besides, this particular model, optically small universe, doesn't solve the problem of light travel time for a young Earth model anyway. If you look at the nearby star that you can see, you know, the first image of some star you're seeing, yes, it took 3 light years for the light to come there from that. But if you're looking at the second image, it had to go all the way around once, so that's 15 light years to go around a 5 light year radius circle, plus the 3 light years to come. You took 18, and the next one took another 15 beyond that, another 15 for the next image, etc. So you still crank up two very big numbers for how long the light would be traveling. That's what that was all about, so we will move on to the next one. Scientific problems of an optically small universe. It postulates that all the stars we see are multiple images of a few stars within 10 light years. Like the multiple images we see in paired mirrors in clothing stores or amusement parks. Trouble is, when you actually look at astronomical photos, that looks unbelievable. Reason? Too much variety in the objects you see there, even in the stars you see there. Color varieties, binaries that are going around one another with different periods and things of that sort. It's hard to see how different reflections could produce any of that kind of variety. And then you see too many large objects that have coherent structures, galaxies, globular clusters, and things of that sort. I don't think there's really any merit to that either. So I think we can discard an optically small universe as well as a miniature universe that we mentioned a little bit earlier. Mm-hmm. Now, when the first big telescopes were developed in this century, the 100-inch telescope on Mount Wilson particularly, some investigators found a rather strange thing as they looked out at the distant galaxies that they were beginning to see with these big telescopes. They found out that the spectral lines in the light coming from these stars was shifted from what it ought to be on the Earth over to the red direction, or to the longer wavelength direction, and that the further away galaxies seemed to be shifted by a greater amount, the greater the distance. So what do you make of that? I'll give a little explanation of what redshift is here. A light coming to us from a star passes from the very hot surface through some cooler gas as it's coming out from the star, and that cooler gas absorbs some of the frequencies and produces dark lines in the spectrum. Or sometimes the light is actually produced by very particular transitions in the energy levels of a particular element, and you get bright lines in the spectrum. And as you look at further and further away galaxies, these seem to be shifted over towards redder color than the same lines that would be produced in an Earth laboratory when you are burning calcium or something of that sort that would produce those kind of lines. Where might this redshift come from? Well, one suggestion that we know about is what we call gravity redshift, light coming out from a strong gravitational field out into a weaker gravitational field appears redder than it would if you were actually down where it was being formed. And the stronger the field, the more redshift. So gravity redshift is a possibility. Motion redshift is a possibility. We already mentioned the technique used in police radar to catch speeders, that the motion of your vehicle toward the police radar shifts the frequency of the signal that's bounced off the front of your car. It shifts it to a higher frequency, which it for light, would be blue-shifted, okay? And if you're moving away from the radar, it would be red-shifted, and the amount of the shift indicates your speed. And obviously some pretty good techniques have been developed for that. Astronomers can't bounce signals off of galaxies or stars and such. They are able to bounce signals off some of the nearest planets. We have done that, sent radar back and forth to those, but can't do it for the other. But we can actually receive the stuff that comes from them, and we can see that certain of the lines are transitions that represent levels in the hydrogen atom or in the calcium or argon or something of that sort. So we're able to do that. All of us personally have actually fairly direct experience with the redshift of sound waves for autos coming and going. If you've ever stood near the side of a highway, say 10 feet off the side just for safety, and listen to cars going by, you'll notice that their engine sounds higher pitched coming towards you and then suddenly shifts to a lower pitch as it goes past. The closer you're standing to the highway, the more obvious this is until you get out in the road and then, interference with the... that's basically what you're observing there, redshift and blueshift, if you like, of sound waves instead of light waves in that particular case. How would we explain this redshift that Slicer and Hubble observed with the 100-inch telescope first? Well, if it was a gravity redshift, that would have to mean that out there where the stars are, there's a very high level of gravity, but it's very low in where we are. And there's no particular reason to believe that that'll be the case for stars coming from this direction and stars that with the light coming from this direction and that direction, etc. There doesn't seem to be that sort of thing peculiar about our place in the universe. So that really does not seem to work for gravity redshift. Motion redshift will certainly work, but it has a fairly strong implication, and that is that the universe appears to be expanding, that all of these galaxies out there are moving away from us. Most cosmologists today think it's actually the space that is expanding, and the galaxies are kind of moving along around one another and such, but the big expansion is because the whole space itself is expanding and these things are moving with it. And the typical illustration they give you is take a balloon and blow it up a little bit and take a magic marker that doesn't have too much balloon-destroying type solvent in it and put polka dots on the balloon and then start blowing it up bigger and bigger, and all of those dots will move away from one another. And the further the dot is from your dot, the one you picked out that's supposed to be our galaxy, the faster they will move away from you. And he said, basically, that's what we think is going on. Well, not all cosmologists have been happy with that particular suggestion. Some have felt, well, maybe there's some other kind of physical process going on that makes light turn red. Jean-Pierre Vivier, I guess his name is, I'm not a French person, has the idea that we have a tired light phenomenon, and our universe is not actually expanding at all. So he suggests that the redshift is due to some kind of unknown mechanism by which light traveling long distances is progressively reddened. Certainly that's not an impossible explanation. It would allow perhaps a finite created universe that is static, although there's a little problem there with static, but it would postulate an unknown mechanism for which we have no other evidence, and that would certainly be some problem. To get a universe, however, that is infinitely large and has always existed and is static, you run into some big problems. And so a static, tired light universe that is eternal would have some very serious problems, I think. One of these is gravity. Gravity's attractive, not repulsive. How would such a universe keep from collapsing? All the stuff beginning to attract each other, and don't see any way around that. Another problem, of course, is stars don't burn forever. How do you recycle the stuff? And both of those are problems for a static universe, and you will see problems for a universe that's always existed as well. If the universe is infinite in size, such a universe violates Olber's paradox. What's that all about? Well, it's about the fact that the sky is dark at night. Yes, around Los Angeles, it looks kind of light at night, but that's due to local light. If you get up above that, the sky looks relatively dark at night. In an eternal, infinite universe, the sky should be infinitely bright, or at least as bright as the sun's surface, which it obviously isn't. So something is going on there. Let's look at Olber's paradox a little more carefully, the problem of the dark sky. Imagine that you arbitrarily divide up the universe into spheres so that they form a concentric sphere so that they form layers like an onion, and you imagine yourself at right in the middle of the onion, okay? And ignore the odor of the onion, and have all of these onion pieces, if you like, are all equally thick. Let's say they're, a million light years thick, okay? And then if the stars are reasonably uniformly distributed in the universe, the number of stars in each layer is going to increase with the square of the radius. That is, they're equally thick, but the surface area goes up as the square. If you didn't have solid geometry, you might not remember this, but the surface of a sphere is 4 pi times the square of the radius. And so it would be the thickness times 4 pi r square would give you the volume of that particular thing. And if the density of stars is fairly uniform, then that's how many you would get. So what that means is that for a onion skin, for an onion layer out twice as far from you as another one, it would have 4 times as many stars. And one 4 times as far, it would have 16 times as many stars. Now, the interesting thing about that is that the apparent brightness of each star decreases with the square of the radius, so that the number of stars cancels it out, so that the amount of light you get from this this onion skin that's one unit away, we'll say you get one unit of brightness from that, and the one that's two units away, you get one unit of brightness from that, and the one that's three units away, you get one unit of brightness from that, and the next one that's four units away, you get one unit of brightness for that. So if you're an infinite unit universe, you get an infinite amount of light. Or if you think in terms of the stars perhaps blocking the light that's coming from behind them, you get light as bright as the surface of the sun. The solution to Olber's paradox is this. The problem is very much like the problem of how far do you have to go into a woods before you can't see out in a horizontal direction. I mean, probably you can see out in a vertical direction unless they're very thick overgrowth. You can't see out in a down direction because the Earth's in the way. But you can probably see out in the other direction. But if you go far enough into the woods, you get to the place where every direction you look, there's a tree trunk blocking your view and you don't see any sky. Well, that's exactly the same kind of problem here, but in three dimensions. How far out can stars be before there are enough of them that every direction you look, there's a star right in your line of sight, and therefore the whole sky ought to be as bright as a star. To have a dark sky, the universe must not be deep enough to see only star surfaces in all directions. Thus, the universe is of finite size, you can see out the edge of it, or finite age, the light hasn't gotten there from the further parts, or an obscure thing which I won't trouble you with, a universe of average density zero. We'll not go into that further. Huh? Now, this problem of light travel time has been a problem that a number of young Earth creationists have dealt with over the years, because it's this. They say the universe is only 6,000, 8,000, 10,000 years old, but it looks like we can see stars that are 20,000, 50,000, 100,000 light years away, a million light years away, etc. And how do you deal with that? And Harold Camping's answer was, the universe is not that big. Okay? Just a few light years, and we'd see that. And the thing of Moon and Spencer was you're actually at light's traveling circles, but that didn't solve the problem at all. But the common view is that the light was created on the way. Universe very large, but only some 10,000 years old. Since most objects visible in our large telescopes are more than 10,000 light years away, the light coming from them was created on the way. There are problems with that. You see, any astronomical object you're looking at that's sending light your way is sending you a stream of information about its history. When you go out in the daytime and look at the sun, you're looking at what was happening on the sun 8 minutes ago when the light left it. When you look at the bright star Sirius, you're looking at what was happening on that star 12 years ago when the light left it. Now, just standing out there eyeballing it without any equipment, you aren't seeing much. You're seeing light. But when you're out there with a spectroscope and some other things of that sort, you can see whether it's moving towards us or away from us, what its rotation speed is. You can see whether flares are going off on the surface and things of that sort. And so each of those stars is sending us a stream of information about their history that took place at the time that light left. Now, let's work that in a younger scheme. At 5,000 light years away, you're looking at what a star was doing 5,000 years ago. At 15,000 light years away, you're looking at what a star would have been doing 15,000 years ago, but it didn't exist. In fact, for 5,000 years more, you'll be getting fictitious history from that star. Something that never happened. And that, I think, is a serious problem. Given that God cannot lie, it seems to me that this view has more problems than the view that the Bible doesn't narrate a recent creation, and that the stars are actually telling us that the universe is at least this old. Another attempt has been made to solve that problem, and that's by the Australian Barry Setterfield. He suggests that the speed of light is changing, and that the speed of light was infinite at creation, so that the moment Adam and Eve were created, they could look up in the sky at night and see stars, and see, in principle, the most distant stars, though not having telescopes, they presumably couldn't see them. But that the speed of light has come down from infinite value and has recently settled down to its current value. Thus, Adam and Eve see the distant stars right away, and no need to accuse God of showing us fictitious history. There are problems with that. One problem might sound a little obscure, but it's easy to visualize at least. Einstein's famous equation. If anybody knows anything about Einstein, it's either about his hair or about E equals mc squared. What is E equals mc squared? It's the relationship between mass and energy. How much mass, when it's converted to energy, how much energy will it make? or if you're converting energy into mass, like in pair production, how much mass will you get from a given amount of energy? And the answer is, you get a lot of energy from a small mass, because c is the speed of light, and squared makes it pretty big. So Einstein's famous equation measures the energy produced by nuclear reactions. So the weight of the water in a cup like this, a few ounces, would be enough to drive your car around the world if you could convert all that mass to energy. Would be no problem with energy shortages or anything of that sort. Well, in Setterfield's view, to have an infinite speed of light at creation and get it down to where it is now, there must have been a time during the patriarchs when the speed of light was 100 times larger than it is now. But if it was 100 times larger, then c squared is 100 times 100 larger, or 10,000 times larger, and the Earth is destroyed by the sun. And you get all that energy rolling over us. On the other hand, if you knock the m down to keep e constant, then the masses are too small to keep any air on our planet or people on our planet. There's some problems there. So there are some rather serious problems relating to a changing speed of light, even though we could not prove that it may not have changed a little bit in recent times. We can actually, however, look at stars out in the sky, and a number of phenomena that take place in particularly in the spectra of stars involve the number c, the speed of light, or c squared, and we can see that we're getting the same kind of numbers from distant stars as we are close by, which suggests that the speed of light was the same when that light left them as it is right now. Not a good way to go to avoid that predicted problem. Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson fairly recently, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, won a Nobel Prize for an observation that they had made back in the 60s, and that was an observation of what is technically called the isotropic radio background. What they found is that when you point a radio telescope to the sky, to the radio telescope, the sky is not black, but gray. Not as bright as you'd expect if the star universe were infinitely old and such, you know, you could see all these star surfaces, but it's not black either. It doesn't get dark at night to a radio telescope, if you like. And the question was, where's this stuff coming from? And for a while, Penzias and Wilson were trying to adjust the electronics of their equipment. They had to get several pigeons who were nesting in the reception horn, what would be the antenna dish today, in their equipment, and get them out. But it didn't change. They were still getting this stuff, and they were getting it daytime and nighttime, different seasons of the year. And so what they found out is this stuff was coming very uniformly from all directions, and at least for the length of time they were running at all times and seasons. And what that really means is that this stuff, whatever it is, this radiation, we're not thinking of a radio program, we're thinking of what would we do with static, was coming not from our solar system, because if it were coming from our solar system, it would be different at different seasons of the year, or it would be different when the horn is facing in different directions, the Earth rotates. Not from the galaxy, we're not in the center of our galaxy, so if it's pointing out of the galaxy, it ought to get a different value than pointing across it. Or from a galaxy cluster, our galaxy cluster doesn't have the stars the same. It's coming from something very uniform out there. And the question was, what is this stuff? Where's it coming from? What's it all about? Recent observations with the COBE satellite show that this stuff coming into us looks like that whatever it is, it's radiating energy like it was an object at 2.7 degrees above absolute zero. What's that cold in the universe? The answer appears to be the universe. Interestingly, such a background radiation was predicted years in advance by the Russian astronomer, astrophysicist George Gamow, as he was developing the consequences of what we call a Big Bang cosmology, in which the universe starts at an enormously high temperature and cools down. He realized that there would come a point when the universe got cool enough that it was no longer ionized, it was no longer opaque to radiation, and it becomes transparent rather quickly. And that point when it switches from opaqueness to transparency, that should have sent out radiation all over the universe at some thousands of degrees. Obviously, thousands of degrees. But as the universe expands after that, that radiation gets cooler and cooler and cooler and cooler, and it ought to have reached, he estimated, something like 5 degrees above absolute zero by this time. It wasn't a bad estimate based on, you know, some sort of seat of pants guess that he was making there. So, in such a scheme, this radiation would be the glow from the instance at which the universe became transparent, something like 100,000 years after creation. The other cosmologies around at the time had no natural explanation for this phenomenon and have not come up with any sense. It's a rather interesting feature of what we call the three-degree blackbody radiations, the name we give it, instead of the isotropic radio radiation. Another discovery of the 60s was what we call quasars. That's a short form for quasi-stellar radio sources. That means they're something that show up in radio telescopes, but when you look at them with, say, optical telescopes, they look like stars. They look like stars through optical telescopes, unusually bright in radio telescopes, and have enormous redshifts. This enormous redshift is really due to distance. Then, by comparing them with the galaxies, they ought to be, most of them, billions of light years away from us, very far out there in space. Now, when I was in grad school at Cornell, this was back in the mid-60s, Thomas Gold was the head of our department, and so we got a pretty good presentation of the steady-state cosmology of Hermann Bondi, Thomas Gold, and Fred Hoyle. Their cosmology had been proposed back in 48, and it was an attempt to avoid a creation, attempt to avoid a creator. Actually, a creation in it, but it didn't have a creator. A creation without a creator, if you like. They were trying to take account of these two things that had been observed in this century, that there were redshifts, which seemed to indicate all these galaxies are moving apart, and so away from us, as we observe it, and that stars run down, and so they don't last forever. And yet, they did not want to have a finite universe that had a beginning. They wanted to preserve an infinite, eternal universe. And so they suggested, our cosmology will give us an infinite, eternal universe that will still have redshifts and still have finite ages, stars, and our universe is philosophically more satisfying than a universe with a beginning. The cosmologists before then had been talking about a cosmological principle, which meant that if you look far enough out in space in any direction, the universe looks about the same. And Bondi, Gold, and Hoyle said, ah, we've got a perfect cosmological principle. Not only if you look in any direction does the universe look the same, if you look at any time in its history, the universe looks the same. How did they do that? Well, they did that by saying that the universe is constantly expanding, but to keep the density of objects from going down, new matter is popping into existence everywhere in the universe by some natural process, no God, by some natural process in order to keep the average density constant. And then these neutrons or whatever they are that are popping into existence, they gradually coalesce into stars and galaxies and planets and all of that sort of thing. So that was a rather popular cosmology all the way to the mid-60s, when several problems became very apparent. One problem was around already from the very beginning, namely that this cosmology violated virtually all the known conservation laws of physics. But, the guy said, well, they violate them all at a level lower than we've ever been able to investigate, so no big deal. Well, I think some other people still thought it was a fairly big deal, but anyway, they couldn't disprove them. So that really wasn't too effective. The one problem it ran into was this black body radiation that had been discovered by Penzias and Wilson. This model doesn't have any natural explanation for that, whereas it's a natural phenomenon of the Big Bang theory. See, in the steady-state theory, the universe has never been particularly hot. It's always been about the temperatures right now. And so you never would have anything left over from this, what we might call a fireball of creation or something that sort of is typically called in the media. Nor for the fact that became apparent that the further out you look in space, there are more quasars in a given volume than there are close by. And it seems to indicate something has been changing in the history of the universe. The universe is aging or something of that sort. And that, of course, was very naturally explained by the Big Bang theory of the universe. So the steady-state theory really bombed out about that time. Not to say that everybody abandoned it. That often isn't the case with many of these kind of models. If you've invested too much emotional thing in something, you hold on to it. The Big Bang cosmology, however, had certain advantages. It fit the observations of an expanding universe and stars that are burning down. It predicted the three-degree blackbody radiation, isotropic radio radiation, giving its frequency dependence exactly. That is, it ought to fit a blackbody radiation spectrum. And I'm not going to have time to explain that here. And even giving an approximate guess on its value, its temperature, which turned out to be rather good. That was interesting. And it fit the observation that quasars are more frequent early in the history of the universe rather than more recently. However, there were several varieties of the Big Bang cosmology. They all agreed that the universe had been very hot and very dense at the time of the Big Bang, but they disagreed on what had happened before. The no-bounce version of Big Bang cosmology is there wasn't a universe before that. The universe began at the Big Bang event, a creation-type model, and the proponent of that was Georges Lemaître, a Belgian Roman Catholic astronomer, who obviously was influenced by a Christian background in that particular matter. Georges Gamow did not like that, the idea that there was a beginning, and so what he did is he took the kind of picture that Gamow would Lemaître would have, and say, no, before the Big Bang, the universe was collapsing, and it bounced at the Big Bang. And we call his model a one-bounce version of the Big Bang cosmology. An eternal universe that infinitely back in the past was just a very thin hydrogen gas doing basically nothing. But as it got closer and closer to the time of the Big Bang, it began gradually to pull itself together under its gravity until finally it bounced at the Big Bang as it got denser and denser and hotter, and then something came into play and stopped it from collapsing and started to bounce. And it's been expanding since then, and it will head off in that direction forever. More popular than the one-bounce version is the oscillating version of the Big Bang cosmology, an eternal universe that expands and contracts and expands and contracts sort of like an accordion, bouncing every, say, 100 billion years or so, and that bounce lasts at the what we call the Big Bang event. So, let's take a look at these. No bounce Big Bang of Lemaître. Universe has not always existed. Came into existence Big Bang event. Might expand forever, or might in principle collapse back into a black hole. Didn't have to make a decision on that particular matter. One bounce Big Bang, Georges Gamow. Universe has always existed. Far back in the past than superhydrogen gas. Gradually pulled together by gravity, getting denser and hotter until it bounces Big Bang. Since then, it has formed galaxies, planets, stars, life. And this universe will end with a whimper, to cite T.S. Eliot's poem. The oscillating Big Bang was popularized by Carl Sagan and Isaac Asimov, eternal, like Gamow's cosmology, no beginning, but will have a bounce every 100 billion years or so. Maybe the bounces will change the basic physical constants, giving a different type of universe on each bounce. For each cycle, the universe ends with a bang. So unlike T.S. Eliot's poem, The Wasteland, or whichever poem that is. Well, there are problems with the oscillating Big Bang and with the one-bounce Big Bang that point very strongly in the direction of a universe that had its beginning at the Big Bang. Oscillating Big Bang, the universe does not appear to have enough matter density to stop its expansion so that it can fall back again and then bounce and such. In fact, it now looks like, just very recent observations suggest the expansion is speeding up, that the universe is expanding faster now than it was earlier in its history. A contracting universe looks like it would collapse into a black hole instead of bouncing and coming back out again. And even if both of these weren't problems, there'd be a question of whether the universe would be able to expand and contract forever without some kind of irreversible changes, rather like we think of in terms of friction or something of that sort. One bounce Big Bang. Same problems with the bounce that the oscillating Big Bang has got, and those are really quite crucial. There's also the problem, perhaps seems more minor, that an infinitesimal rate of contraction is going to produce a single universe-wide big bounce at some particular time in history. That is something very strange if you think of the physics of something of that sort. The present situation is that virtually all your cosmologists have moved over to something like a no-bounce Big Bang. They at least will argue that our universe today is finite in size and finite in age and had a definite beginning at the Big Bang. Now, many of them are not ready to leave it at that point. They're still opting for that eternal universe. They seem to be hoping that our universe is just a subset of an infinite eternal universe in which ours is just a transient bubble. It's very hard to see how to test this, since by definition almost you can't see outside the bubble to be able to see anything beyond there. We try to pull everything together then. We still don't know enough about cosmology to specify single best model, but we can say these things. The universe gives every evidence of being large, enormously large. Universe certainly looks old, but it's a finite age. The universe appears to be created. And see that from the beginning, etc., and some things about design that we talked about last night, which we might be able to talk about here. Some variety of the no-bounce Big Bang model seems to best fit the current data. Now we come over to the biblical material. What does biblical data have to say about this? The Bible pictures the universe as immeasurably large, but apparently finite in size. We'll look at some passages in a moment on that subject. The Bible says the cosmos was created at a finite time in the past by an infinite personal God of the Bible, and it evidences his craftsmanship. The Bible pictures the universe as running down. Many see the Bible as picturing the universe as only a few thousand years old, and this is the standard reason which many people reject the biblical account on the one hand, or if they're Bible believers, reject scientific discussions in cosmology as being biased and such on the other hand. Let's take a look at these in turn. Universe is immeasurably large. Several passages, I've two of them here for you. Jeremiah 33:22, God speaking through Jeremiah says, I will make the descendants of David as countless as the stars of the sky and as measureless as the sand on the seashore. Well, the suggestion there is that putting the stars of the sky and the sand of the seashore together, that there are a lot more stars out there than anybody in antiquity could have seen. The hint that we've got a very big universe. And then in Psalm 8, verses 3 and 4, the psalmist, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and stars which you've set in place, what is man that you're mindful of him? We get a picture that the psalmist is amazed that God cares about humans, given this creation he sees out there. This argument has recently been used by atheists as an argument against God. How can your God care about your puny stuff like where you lost your keys or something of that sort? And the biblical answer to that, I think, is that our God is able to handle the big stuff and the little stuff simultaneously. He's an infinite God who is able to do even better than multitasking computers can in being able to keep track of all sorts of things simultaneously. The universe is finite. Psalm 147 says of God, he determines the number of the stars and calls them each by name. Well, determining the number of something that's infinite would be tricky. And we've already seen that there's quite a lot of them. And calling them each by name would be even trickier. You'd say, well, you know, if you just speak fast enough, you can eventually call all of the infinite number of them by name. But you're thinking in terms of stars that only have 10-letter names. But if you've got an infinite number of stars, almost all of them have got to have infinite letter names, okay, to be able to distinguish them from one another. So I think we're looking at a finite universe, although I would not want to press that to death. So I will leave that there. Universe is created. It's very, very clear in Scripture. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, a remark of the writer of Hebrews. By faith, we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what is visible. But you have something there, a creation ex nihilo or something of that sort is pictured in that kind of thing. Universe's design. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. And then it goes on to say that this is visible daytime and nighttime. It's visible anywhere on earth. There's no language barrier, etc. And what it's saying is something distinct about God's greatness, God's distinctiveness, shows up in what he made. And it reminds us of how you tell the difference between a good potter and a crummy potter. You look at the pots, okay? That's how you tell. Okay? How do you tell the difference between a good painter and a crummy painter? It's gotten trickier since modern art came on the scene. But I'll leave that one, but we'll come move on here. Since the creation of the world, says Paul, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. The universe is designed, and as we suggested last night, there's very good evidence in that direction from nature itself. The universe is running down. Psalm 102, and then quoted again in Hebrews 1, in the beginning, you, speaking of God, laid the foundations of the earth and the heavens the work of your hands. They will perish, but you remain. They will all wear out like a garment, like clothing. You will change them and they'll be discarded. Interestingly, it's wear out like a garment, and thinking of the universe running down as kind of the machine analogy or the wind-up clock analogy that we use on it today. But here, wear out like a garment. And that indeed is what we see our universe doing. The major sticking point, I think, for many people in accepting the Bible as God's word is they feel the Bible teaches the universe is young. And if indeed it requires a young universe, then you either got to say the Bible is right and I'm going to hold to that young universe, or you've got to say the Bible is wrong and I'll go look at some other religion. This is the traditional understanding of the Bible. Probably numbers were not always given to the thing, although if you look at Orthodox Jewish calendar, they have a date for creation. You're aware, no doubt, that Archbishop Usher tried to calculate a date for creation. That is 4004, which has been some beat to death by opponents of Christianity. But certainly something of that sort is a traditional understanding of the Bible. It's the main reason, certainly, for the strength of the young earth creationist movement among Bible believers. We live in a society where the foundations of Christianity and morality are being attacked, and we're trying to defend them. And so we want to defend, and a common thing to do is if some secular humanist says yes, we say no. That can be dangerous sometimes. However, I don't believe the Bible teaches the earth is young. Clearly can be read that way. No question about that. It doesn't teach the earth young. It does not say how long it was from when God first created until Abraham, something of that sort. It does not say the days of Genesis are literal or consecutive, and I don't even like the word literal there, because I would say, for a particular vocabulary word, any of its standard usages is a literal meaning of the word. And if that's so, you can show that for the Hebrew word yom, just as for the English word day, that one of the uses of the word is a long period of time, back in Harry Truman's day sort of thing we use today, and that sort of structure is used in the Bible as well. So Christians have gone in various directions to try to solve this problem. Some have said, the earth is young, and whatever science disagrees with it, I'm just going to reject. And if they're right, then that's the way to go. Some concern not to overpress that particular matter. The Bible does not say that genealogies of Genesis 5 and 11 should be added up to get a chronology, and the writer of the Bible in that passage is Moses, does not do that. So I don't know whether we should be doing that. Is the universe old? Well, I have some arguments for that in the book Genesis 1, The Origin of Earth. Hugh Ross, whom you've heard here about 2 years ago, has arguments for that in Creation and Time. There are other materials out there floating around. There's going to be a book off the press here from Zondervan just this spring in which the three views of creation evolution among Christians, the young earth creation position, the old earth creation position, the theistic evolution position, are going to be debated. I wound up writing the old earth stuff. Paul Nelson, just got a doctorate in Chicago, is writing the young earth creation stuff, and Howard Van Til, a professor of physics at Calvin College, wrote the theistic evolution stuff. So we each wrote our stuff, what we thought were our best arguments. And then instead of getting a look at the other guy's stuff and shooting at it, we're out of the picture at that point. They bring in four guys, a scientist, a philosopher, a theologian, and an exegete, and they say, you guys critique these three guys. And so they write critiques for each of us. And all I've seen is my stuff and their critique, and then I write a response to their critique. I still haven't seen two-thirds of the book, but it's coming out in March, and you can get it. Do I get a cut in the royalty? I doubt it. I think they'll just pay me a flat fee. But whatever happens, you should think through those things. Because the Lord wants us to be as effective as we can in reaching out to unsaved people around us. And the fewer places we're wrong about things, the more likely we are to be effective with them. Though none of us are going to get them all right before the end. I feel quite confident for that. An earth and universe some billions of years old is not taught explicitly in the Bible either, but it's not a disagreement with a fair and reasonable interpretation of the biblical creation account. I'll be glad to try and field a couple things in our question and answer session tonight, and particularly our question and answer session tomorrow, which is a session devoted to that whole particular matter. But I think there's some hints in the Bible that the universe may be quite a bit older than a few thousand years. And there's an explicit statement in the Bible that suggests that the universe is telling us a true story about who God is and what he's doing and that sort of thing. We put there. And this skier has nothing to do with my presentation, but it's built into this particular computer. Okay, thank you very much.
The way we want to handle this is we're going to be open for questions for a few minutes from the floor, and then at a time that seems appropriate, Dr. Newman will stop those and we'll let people leave if they want to. And well, actually, you're free to go at any time, I guess. I don't think we have guards on the doors. And then we'll still be here for a while for people who want to wander up and ask questions privately. But do remember that there's an open question and answer session tomorrow evening, so the whole evening session will be devoted to talking about these things. So if you have a question you don't quite have formed, you have a day to think about it.
Yes, sir. Sir?
Hear me, sir, or I have to take the microphone? Say it again.
Yes, state it again,
okay.
Please.
First page of Genesis, right there, says God created heaven and earth and day and night before sun was created. Now, to me, looks like an illogical statement against the facts of science, which I'm sure, with your knowledge and experience, you believe in that the sun was first and earth was much, much later, and day and night happened after the sun and earth was formed and circulating around each other.
I discussed that in some detail in Genesis 1 and the Origin of the Earth, which there's some copies of out there. But let me give you a quick sketch. I suggest that God has led Moses, if that's who he had write the Genesis account, perhaps he had an earlier patriarch even write the Genesis account, had him write it as what this would look like if you were down here where these things are happening, rather than up there where God is and these things are happening. And so when God says, let there be light, that is the light of the sun. But because of the solar nebula, you cannot see the sun at that point. And then as the earth is formed up, it has a cloud cover on it. We've got good evidence for that from statements in Job. And then as God creates the vegetation, that clears the cloud cover, and you begin to see the sun and moon for the first time at that particular point. So that's how I would read that. Is a perspective, you don't have to agree, the perspective of seeing the thing from the surface of the earth, what it would look like to an observer at that point. Question? Yes, here. First slide.
One of the first slides, you asserted that the creator has to be a person, and I was wondering why you give a kind of an anthropomorphic take to that.
Okay, well, some of that's going to depend on how you define person, okay? If by person you mean human, no, the creator does not need to be a human, and my understanding is the creator was never a human until the incarnation when Jesus becomes a human. But person is used in theology and probably in philosophy to mean a type of a being that can make decisions, that can communicate with other persons, and such. Usually you think in terms of will and perhaps emotion of one sort or another, and there's something else in that direction. But basically, I would suggest that the evidence of design in nature suggests a designer, and the only model we have for designers that we can show actually works are persons of one sort or another. So that's what I would suggest in that direction. That when you get into the impersonal model, there are obviously people who think that they can build a complicated enough computer eventually that it will become a person or something of that sort. I'm very skeptical of that, but willing to wait and see what happens. That's basically what I mean by person.
I was just curious, how old do you think the universe is? I mean, in terms of approximate numbers, and why you would pick that approximate number rather than just, you know, generally old versus generally young?
Yeah. As best I can tell from looking at the data that's currently being examined, we're probably talking around 15 billion years for the age of the universe, and probably around 5 or a little less for the age of the sun and earth and the planets and such. It appears that early in the history of the universe, you do not have the right kinds of elements in our universe to even be able to build planets. And so you've got a first, second, maybe in the third generation. Well, how many generations of stars there are depend drastically on what size the stars are. Big stars run through their money fast, their energy fast, and little stars are very frugal. So little stars can last a long time. There are probably a number of little stars around from very early on, but the big stars have all wiped out. So as those big stars burn through their stuff, if they wipe out spectacularly, they scatter a lot of heavy elements all over their neighborhood, what a supernova does. And when astrophysicists talk about heavy elements, they're not talking about lead. Well, they are talking about lead and gold and that sort of thing, but they're also talking about carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen. And it appears that you need at least one cycle through a star to be able to produce into that. You can not produce in the Big Bang, where it produces hydrogen, helium, maybe a little lithium and such. No, further. Get down here. I'm not sure. I'm not excited with million years sort of stuff that is typical in evolutionary circles. And I think probably what they're looking at are apes of some sort, rather than humans. The one thing that I would see out of scientific material that might give some suggestions is the material surrounding what's called mitochondrial Eve and Y chromosome Adam. In looking at the way our genetic material is transmitted from parent to child, there is a set of genetic material in each of our cells that comes only from a mother, because that's the DNA that is off in another side compartment called a mitochondrion. I love those in a cell, but those come only from the mother, they don't come from the father. And so an experiment was done some years ago, and I think it's been repeated a couple of times, to try and find out how far back the last common ancestress of mankind is. And they had done some stuff with chimps, and they found that that all the chimps seemed to go back 5 million years. And they'd done something with gorillas, and they found that all the gorillas seemed to go back 5 million years. So the suggestion was, well, man should go back there. But the number they got was between 100 and 200,000. Enormously shorter period back to that. They were able to put a spin on it after a little while and say this must be an indication that mankind was very restricted, very small population for a long time in order to get all of the population to have one mother, though in fact there were lots of mothers back at that particular time. That's the spin they put on it. It's a little bit like the joke of why some Koreans are named Kim, and I won't get into that particular question. But that was the direction they went. But then they did a similar experiment to try and trace the last male ancestor, and one of our chromosomes is not shared with females. That's the Y chromosome. And so that measures descent from your father and his father and his father and his father back. And so they looked at the variation within that to try and figure out how far that went back. And they got something like about 50,000 years. Whoa. That's nowhere near what they expected to get. They expected to get a big number again and show that the other was a fluke or something of that sort. So the media tended to laugh it off by saying, well, Eve had to wait, 50,000 years to marry Adam or something of that sort, and let it ride that direction. But in fact, the Bible suggests that all of us are probably descended from Eve as our last common female ancestors, but that we're all descended from Noah as our last common male ancestor, because all the men on the ark were either Noah or descended from him. But the women, we don't know, okay? They're certainly not his daughters. There's no statement in that direction. And we don't know what his relationship with his wife is. So we may be getting very rough numbers for the creation and for the flood out of those things. And those are numbers which are consistent with some kind of an older thing, but don't fit very well a theistic evolution model and don't fit very well in our model. So I'm not ready to climb out a limb on it because I don't think the technique they use is likely to give you really accurate values. But there it is. And so what do you do then with what look like fossils that go back a million years or something of that sort? Well, one answer would be, even if the dates are correct, which I'm willing to grant, but I'm not a specialist to be able to guarantee that or anything, they may not be humans. What are humans? They look a certain way. Well, we do. But how much can you look like humans and not be human? Well, you'd have to figure out what the distinctive features of humans are. And we would suggest from the Bible it's probably image of God, and then trying to unpack what that is from the other biblical statements about image of God. Some kind of personhood, some kind of creative abilities of some sort, some kind of moral features and such, and not sure exactly on how to draw the line on that sort of thing. My inclination then would be to say that the Australopithecines and such are apparently not human, and not apparently ancestors of human. Recent evidence has seemed to suggest that maybe the Neanderthals are not ancestors of surviving humans. And I'm not sure what to make of that. So we'll let that ride. They are still considered Homo sapiens Neanderthalus, whereas we're considered Homo sapiens sapiens. So obviously the question of how you draw up a genealogical chart and how you draw up the relationships when you can't interview the persons make it very tricky. We don't know for sure what range of abilities. We've got some surviving stuff. Clearly Neanderthals could make tools and such, and fairly impressive tools. Don't have as much handle on the other. So I know evangelicals who are old Earth creationists who disagree on the question of how Neanderthal might be related to us. That's where I gotta leave it. I take it to be an unsolved problem, but one that certainly does not seem to be an insuperable. Question back here.
Thank you. I don't know if I have a question so much as an observation.
Go ahead.
Maybe get your reaction to it. You said right there at the end that one of the major sticking points for people accepting the Bible is the idea of a young universe, and yet you quoted it in your presentation. Romans 1:20 pretends the creation of the world, man's invisible qualities have been clearly seen. I know you probably don't want to get into a Bible study tonight, but the very next verse says, which I'm sure you're aware of, for although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, for their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they were, they claimed to be wise, they became fools. Those two verses together would indicate that a major sticking point for people accepting the Bible isn't so much a different view of cosmology as it is a moral or spiritual problem.
I don't think there's any question that a moral spiritual problem is a very serious one. I think the illustration of what's been happening in the impeachment situation shows us how spin can be put on things and how people can be reluctant to deal with certain kinds of evidence. That's true. That's true. So I think what Christians need to do is try and figure out which of the things are those kind of things and which of the things may be our bad apologetics or misinterpretation of Scripture and things of that sort. I'm satisfied that the Bible is God's Word and that God cannot lie. I'm satisfied that the universe is God's world and it contains a message and God cannot lie. So the two do have to fit together, but I'm not sure I know exactly how they fit together in everything. And so I'm trying to deal with that, and I haven't got all the problems solved. Okay, so we come back to that. But you're right, there is certainly that kind of a bias lurking there. Remember, though, we're sinners too, and that doesn't disappear like that when we get saved. Hopefully, it starts getting better, but it doesn't disappear. So we have to watch that as well. Yes. Well, let's see. I'll give you this one down here, and then I'll try and look over here for a change. Sorry.
You mentioned that. A couple of scientists noticed that at night, if you look through a radio telescope, it's gray, right? It's not black. And, you also said that the speed of the universe is expanding at us, it's speeding up. Would that mean that the gray would be less gray? Is it getting lower in temperature?
What you're looking at with the gray stuff, we think, is the point at which the universe switches from opaque to transparent. Okay? And so that is probably very close to one particular time in the history of the universe, which tentative suggestion on an old Earth scheme and such is about 100,000 years after the Big Bang, and since that's 15 billion years ago, it's pretty close to the front. What they would see regarding speeding up would be that some objects that can be observed somewhat close to the beginning of the universe, like early galaxies, etc., or early variable stars, seem to have a redshift that is different than they would have expected, but would suggest that the universe wasn't expanding quite as fast back then as it is now. And I'm a little fuzzy on putting that together. I've just seen a couple of reports in Science News rather than they bring the details of that in. But that's how it reads, at least from what I've seen so far. Questions over here, the other side of here. Yes, go ahead.
And I have the same problem as I asked before. God created heaven and earth and etc., etc. Except the heavens, everything is physical. You have spent a lot of time studying it. You have given a big lecture on the nature and the laws of physics and chemistry and everything else. How shall I study the heavens in the same fashion as study cosmology or cosmos? Is there a model we can create, or is there existence, or is laws of physics or science can be applied to that, or is just an abstract something which we don't even know what it is?
Okay. Part of the complication, I think, part of the complication is that the Bible uses the word heaven for three different things. I'm guessing from Paul's third heaven remark. Three different things. Where the birds fly, the birds of heaven. Where the stars are, the stars of heaven. Where God's special manifestation is, the angels of heaven,